Hello, aviators. My name is Chris Palmer from Angle of Attack with another series of questions for Ask the CFI. We do Ask the CFI every Monday to kick off your week in a positive way, answering your flight training, aviation career, flying, written tests, all sorts of different questions related to your aviation journey. Pretty much anything goes here. I typically take these questions from Instagram, where I post a story each Sunday afternoon or evening for you to enter in your questions. And then on Monday, I answer those live on Instagram and then record them here for you so that you can see them on YouTube and then also listen to them on the podcast Aviator Cast from Angle of Attack. So it's great to have you here. If this is your first time, welcome. There's lots of material here for you. Please subscribe and like this as you go throughout. Comment on anything that you want more clarity on or any thoughts that you have. That is also really helpful. And this is also a searchable index, at least here on YouTube, where you can search out the question, hit the time code, and that'll take you to the question that you are interested in that is relevant for you. So let's dive right into these questions and jump into Ask the CFI. Let's start with something that's a little bit just technical and start to talk about that. So having a hard time with my power off stall, any tips? So the power off stall is also known as the approach to landing stall. And I've really tried to rename it myself to make sure that I connect that approach to landing to it, because that will tell you everything you need to know about setting up your power off stall. So you're coming into the pattern, right? You're gonna be landing. You're reducing your power back as you're coming into the pattern, power off. That's how we know we are doing a power off stall. We're emulating a landing. So you will typically do this with flaps. You will, you can either do it straight ahead or you can do it in a banked turn. Essentially, this one is really easy. With the flaps out in most airplanes, the airplane is more docile in the stall. You don't have the left turning tendencies that the power on stall. We know that if you have that powerful throttle or even partial throttle, that you are going to get those left turning tendencies that will pull the nose one way. In a power off stall, you don't really have that, so the airplane is fairly docile. What I do is I get the airplane in approach speed, say 60 to 70 miles per hour in a Cessna 172. And then all you do is you pull the nose up to the horizon, okay? You put the top of the cowling right on the horizon in a 172. It's gonna be different in other airplanes. And then you hold it there until you get the stall and the indications. With the flaps down, you're going to get a fairly mild stall. You'll feel it buff it, you'll hear the stall warning horn, and you may get that momentary drop. And as a pilot, you are the one forcing it there, right? You're forcing it to that horizon. So all you need to do to recover is relax the pressure on the yoke, reduce the angle of attack, and then you can get the wing flying again. Now, the recovery, the entire recovery, is reducing the angle of attack so you get out of the critical angle of attack. The wing is flying again just by you doing that little bit of change in your pitch attitude, and then adding power in and climbing out of that approach to landing stall. So we're essentially emulating that we've come in, we've for some reason become distracted and we got too slow and we got to a stall condition and we really do want to have that power in there to recover. You still can just put that nose right on the horizon, and that's gonna give you enough of a climb. And then you would want to reduce your flaps by one notch if you are, say, at 30 degrees. You could even go to 20 degrees in 172. So a couple different helpful things there. Power up, pitch up, clean up, basically. Power up, power forward, pitch up, clean up. That's the recovery after you've reduced the angle of attack and got the wing flying again. And then you minimize how much altitude you lose, all right? So it's all about that recovery. And there you go. I'm about 10 hours away from my check ride. You have any tips or any podcast episodes I should listen to leading up to the check ride? One thing I do have, and I've noticed that a lot of people do need advice when they are getting close to their check rides, is I created a program called Check Ride Ace. It's available on my website, angleofattack.com, for $99. You can actually get a trial for $1 and see the first entire lesson, the first entire section rather, that kind of builds up to the rest of the course. But that's a really useful course if you're getting into the check ride. It helps you organize your check ride. So I have the check ride checklist, all the things you need to take to the check ride, including the paperwork, the materials you need, the endorsements you need, the logbook entries, all those things. And then I have the study guide, which is the best part, which is a fill in the blank, essentially in the order you'll do during the oral portion, you'll fill in that stuff. I do have a handful of podcasts out there as well on this topic. Aviatorcast is my podcast. You can find it anywhere on YouTube, on my channel there. iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, it's everywhere. And I have several on that that topic. Particularly, you're going to want to go to the episode of How to Avoid Study Burnout, and that is the one that you'll find for Private Pilot along those lines. So I hope that helps. It's good you asked about podcasts and things because I usually do already have resources for a lot of those different things. Best way to memorize airspace, dimensions, etc. There is there's a handful of ways of doing it. I think that probably the best thing to do when it comes to memorizing airspace is to just work around it, work within it. And so one of the best things you can do is to pick up an iPad with 4Flight or even your phone and get a really good idea of where that airspace is. It is hard to interpolate, you know, the rules that you have with airspace, the altitudes that you have with that airspace, especially the airspace that isn't charted, and then how to visualize that in 3D space when you're actually going through it. So I know that is a bit of a chore. One of the nice things about 4Flight now is that for the airspace, they have their own aeronautical layer over the top, so you can actually click within airspace and see its dimensions. I just find that a lot of the, especially VFR sectional charts, are pretty cluttered with their information. So you can get really good airspace information with 4Flight by clicking within those sectors. And that tends to work pretty well. So yeah, just know it from front to back. A big thing I want you to get into in your study in that is know the difference between controlled airspace and an uncontrolled airspace. Controlled airspace is anything basically except class golf airspace, but class golf airspace is hardly ever depicted on a chart. So really knowing where class golf and class echo are, because they aren't charted all the time, is really important to understand between those two. Otherwise, everything should be charted. And then you have the airspace just as it makes sense. So obviously the bigger cities are going to have the class Bravo airspace, the class Charlie airspaces. You're going to have lower levels of class echo airspace around even rural airports. So we have kind of a step down here as a pilot would fly in an instrument approach through controlled airspace of going from that 1200 feet down to 700 feet shaded, you would see on the chart, and then surface level at our airport echo of that dashed magenta. So knowing why the airspace is structured is also very important. I do talk a lot about that in my ground school, but yeah, I think that's the best way to put it. Just get creative and start to look around different areas and what is out there. Thoughts on ATP Flight School and other fast-paced programs. I think there are plenty of great pilots that come out of these programs, or at least they end up becoming great pilots. It is nice to go to a place that has good financing set up through lending institutions. I know that that's a big thing for people, is the availability of money and making this dream happen with a large loan. And I think it can work out pretty well that way. They do charge a lot extra from what you actually get. So that's a struggle for me, is that you take on a big loan, but maybe don't get as much out of it as you could if you're just paying out of pocket. But that is what it is, I guess, if you can't get financing any other way or you can't save for it. I don't necessarily think that they turn out great pilots. I think that the training is, you get done just what needs to get done, and that's pretty much it. That's why it is accelerated. And then separating from ATP itself and going more to like a fast-paced program, you know, these 2-week private pilot courses, 10-day IFR or 1-week IFR. I'm really not a huge fan. I have had friends go through it themselves, and I haven't met someone personally yet that has passed one of those courses. Not saying that many don't, I'm sure many do, but cramming things down, really, you really aren't getting anywhere. ATP is doing a lot better than these 2-week or 1-week courses. They just aren't that great. I did one of these myself for the first try for instrument, ended up failing my check ride, and it was some of the worst training I've ever had. Just wasn't good. And too much, too soon, not quality anyway, just, I don't know, wasn't a great experience. So I definitely don't suggest that. What do you think about the situation in aviation industry for new commercial pilots? It is tricky right now. Obviously, we know that the airlines have been drastically reduced in their loads. There was an airline yesterday here in Alaska, our only airline that serves our town here, our small town, that stopped all flights, laid off the rest of their employees, filed for Chapter 11 until everything's over. A lot of my pilot friends had already been laid off from the company. So we're without airline service now to our town, and there's really kind of an indefinite end mark to that. It is a little tricky right now, but my perspective is that we will get back to normal eventually. We have to. I'm not sure how quickly that rise is going to be, but I know that I'm eager to get out there and travel again, go places, achieve things, do things, even go places with my family. And we've got to get through this. We've got to find a way to get through this. So that's kind of my beginning message on those that are looking to go through aviation right now, even in these uncertain times, is you have nothing to lose by starting to work through it and keeping that dream. And especially starting with those things that are knowledge things like ground school and getting into the books and getting started in a lot of different areas. Not a super great time to go and get a $100,000 loan to get all your training. I'd maybe wait a month or two on that and just kind of see how things pan out. But I think that for those that stick to this, you know, the world has been through things before, like 9/11 and a bunch of different events, that this too shall pass and we'll find a way through it, and there will be a demand for pilots again. So I think we've got to keep our eye on the ball and keep progressing toward those dreams and those goals. In case of engine failure after takeoff, what is the best action in different aircraft positions? So there has been some speculation recently about something called the impossible turn. As instructors and as kind of a safety mechanism in aviation, we've called the impossible turn that turn back from the runway after you've taken off and you have an engine failure. So say you've taken off, you're at about 500 feet, you have an engine failure. Can you successfully turn back to the runway and land on the runway? And many, many people have died trying this. Smaller general aviation airplanes that are made for training, like a 172, Cherokee 140, Bonanzas, most of the airplanes that we use in general aviation cannot do this. It is very unsafe to do this. You have to be a trained aerobatic pilot to be able to pull this off. There are some people recently that have been speculating that it can be done, but that's typically done with a bush aircraft, with high lift devices, lightly loaded, good weather. So we still need to consider that final, or rather that departure leg, as the impossible turn. If you're flying straight out and you're below 1,000 feet, I think that's still my minimums, you should be landing somewhere straight ahead or within 30 degrees from where you're at. It's the big steep turn back that really dissipates your energy, where you lose altitude, that's a little bit scary. Now, do you just do a huge long final or a big departure leg and just keep flying straight out? Well, if while you have power, you turn a crosswind at a reasonable time, say 500 feet, between 500 and 800 feet, and you turn that crosswind leg, well, now you only have a 90 degree turn back to the runway, essentially, and the entire situation has just changed. So then I would absolutely try to get back to the runway at that point, or at least back to the airport environment where I know it's free of obstructions and things. And then if you're on downwind, I mean, you can absolutely land on the runway if you're on downwind at almost any position. So I would definitely think of that too. Knowing where the terrain is around you, the buildings, the parking lots, the golf courses on your departure path is a good procedure to go through and be familiar with that. I think that that can add to that safety of the impossible turn. I do still think we should be considering it as impossible because the average pilot cannot do it. I wouldn't do it. I would still land straight ahead, 30 degrees either side. That's what I'm gonna do because I know that that turn back is very dangerous. We can get into a stall spin accident. Couple questions along these lines today of both high school degree, this looks like undergrad degree. Let's talk about full bachelor degrees too. So there was a time when airlines required bachelor's degrees, especially the legacy carriers or the large carriers, anywhere from Alaska, Southwest, Delta, United, American, they were all requiring four-year degrees. That's been changing a little bit, and they've taken that restriction out of their hiring, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they still don't look at that in a good way. I'm not sure I'm a huge proponent of doing a professional aviation degree, meaning you actually go to school for a professional pilot sort of thing. I started out doing that myself, and I just think that it's better to have something to fall back on, like aviation business, airport management, business in general. I think there are a lot of different things you could get a degree in that are more of a fallback or something that can add to your aviation career rather than just the aviation career itself. Then you can get your flight training cheaper outside of school and do it part 61, as we'd call it. All right. So that's kind of the four-year degree thing. You know, I think the two-year degree thing is going to be valuable to some people. They'll look upon that in a positive light. And then in terms of doing well in high school, they may not look at your actual transcripts and your grades and things, but it is good to have done well in high school. As pilots, as aviators, we are committing ourselves to a certain degree of excellence that is above and beyond. And in whatever way you can to build yourself up and to be a better student is always going to pay off well for your aviation career. And having that attitude and that curiosity to continue to learn is something that every pilot needs to begin with. But of course, there are still those institutions that require that four-year degree or want that two-year degree. But remember that the FAA certifications are outside of the university system, and it's just FAA. And if you got these all outside of college but still did college, it's still going to be just as valid when you go and apply to the airlines. How do you develop your rudder control and feel of the aircraft when you were a student pilot? I especially have trouble maintaining, and they went on to say, control over the center line as they are going down the runway on takeoff or on landing. And here's the thing. There are many different things acting upon the airplane that can pull us from side to side, okay? And essentially that is what we are trying to counteract with the rudder, is from side to side. When we're talking about roll with the ailerons, we're talking about more this way, which there is a little crossover combination with the rudder, but not much. And of course we know that our pitch is bringing us up and down. So knowing where the things come from that are affecting the airplane and requiring you to use your rudder is important to realize from the get-go. So let's talk about takeoff for just a moment. So as you're taking off, you're standing still, right? You're powering up the propeller, pushing it forward, very slow airspeed. It's really, really turning hard and creating a lot of horsepower and torque and slipstream and P factor and all this stuff without a lot of airflow over the control surfaces, okay? So as you start your takeoff roll, you're going to have the airplane wanting to pull quite a bit to the left. It's really gonna wanna pull to the left depending on the horsepower of your engine. During the entire takeoff, you're going to have a varying amount of right rudder pressure, okay? Because it's constantly pulling to the left in a traditional American-made airplane, it is going to be pulling to the left. You're going to need to counteract to the right with pressure. Finding the amount of pressure and decreasing or increasing that pressure to maintain that center line is really what you're looking for. We're not looking so much for jabs of the rudder as we are constant pressure. We're talking about nose wheel airplanes, traditional tricycle gear training airplanes. Constant pressure, relaxing and increasing as you're going throughout that takeoff. Okay, we're talking wheels still on the ground here. So finding that sweet spot, finding right where you need to be, and keep the pressure right where it needs to be to keep that center line. All right, and now as we're rotating off the runway, things change. The wind can start to act upon the airplane where it wants to weather vane. You do get another left turning tendency as it pitches up that can pull it even more to the left. So as you're pulling that nose up, sometimes you'll even want to do a little bit of bump of right, extra right rudder for that moment to keep us straight, to keep us coordinated, to keep us climbing. All right, and then throughout your climb, your initial climb, we know that it's still pulling left. We're at a slower airspeed, it's still pulling left, and we need that continuous right rudder pressure to stay coordinated, all right? So my whole point there with rudder coordination and rudder control is knowing first and foremost where these pressures, these forces are that are working upon you that you need to be counteracting for. Because if you have a lot of power, or you're going to add a lot of power, even in flight, you know it's going to pull to the left. If you reduce that power quickly, well, it's going to go back to the right because you're reducing the left tendency all of a sudden. So try to work more on getting in the books, finding out where that actually comes from so that you can know what you're doing when you're actually doing that. And then you'll know that it's just a matter of pressure when it comes to the rudder. Okay? Hope that helps you out a little bit. That's how I teach my students, or at least one way to phrase that. And I hope that works well for you. How many hours per week should a student pilot average to stay proficient? I would say a couple flights per week are the best way to stay on your game and be progressing. One flight per week is plenty to keep your proficiency, I think. That'll definitely keep you on track. I also want you to think about keeping your proficiency even outside of flying an airplane. You can do that with continuous study. You can do that through watching YouTube videos, podcasts, whatever. Just keeping your head in the game and keeping that language coursing through your brain, that aviation vocabulary, is very, very helpful. So think of that as well, that even while you're not flying, there are plenty of flying type activities you can be doing to keep your mind engaged in aviation. There's just so much content out there that it's really helpful. I'm looking into buying and renting out a small plane. Any advice? There's also another one that asked if buying a plane was a good investment. I think those are kind of two different subjects, but they do have some crossover. You know, airplanes typically hold their value if you maintain them well and it's a good market. Right now, there's a little bit of uncertainty on if the market will go down or not just because of supply and demand. There may end up being some flight schools that go out of business, and so we see some more airplanes on the market here for a little bit. But we'll see. I'm not quite sure about that. You know, we all could make it through this just fine. So I think buying and renting out a plane as like a business, you got to lease it through a business. Make sure that whoever is renting out the plane is doing so well. You're going to have to pay for insurance if you're doing it yourself. It just does get a little bit tricky, and you're just going to need to be careful with that the airplane is being used for good purposes, that the person who is flying the plane is getting checked out. A lot of it ends up coming down more to an insurance thing than a regulation sort of thing, because if you let someone take your airplane that's not supposed to take your airplane, even though you're insured, and they end up crashing it, then you're not going to be covered. So I'm always really careful to protect our airplane from situations like that, to make sure that we're always within the scope of insurance, just in case something happens, we're covered and we're actually using the insurance. So more along those lines, and then, you know, it does become a business thing with separating yourself from the liability. That's why something like an LLC or a business, keeping it under that is gonna be helpful. But that's a whole different subject in and of itself. I do lease the airplane for our flight school. My neighbor owns it. I'm thinking about buying it. It's something that we're kind of thinking about, but you gotta be really careful about it, protect that asset, and then it will, as the other question is, it will be a good thing to resell at some point, typically. they do hold their value pretty well, especially if you take care of them. Do online ground schools actually teach you enough for the written and so on? Not all of them do. Some of them are fairly surface level and talk in more generalities about aviation and what you're going to go through for that particular license. Now, I do have an online ground school for private pilot and instrument. They're separate courses. And I've really taken this question into account when I created them, because I felt like when I went through my training, I didn't feel like I had great resources to just kind of one-stop shop and get everything done and feel like I really knew the material. I don't even like to teach stuff just for rote memorization periods. You know, there are some things we need to know of details, like how many takeoffs and landings we need within 90 days, and day and night rules, and tailwheel and tricycle gear rules. So there are some things you have to memorize, of course, but understanding more the why behind a lot of what we do is better. Kind of like the airspace question I answered earlier. That was just a really quick example of understanding the why to airspace, so that you understand why it's built the way it is. Then you can visualize it better and understand it better. And then you can read the map better. And then when you're flying in the air, you can plan better to get in or around that airspace. So that's just the best thing for me to think about when it comes to ground schools. And I've really tried to achieve that with our ground school at angleofattack.com. Do you prefer a Piper or a Cessna for private pilot training? It doesn't matter. The Cherokees, they're great airplanes. 152s, 172s, even 182s are great airplanes for training. It really just depends. And they all fly pretty similarly with a couple of quirks here and there, but they're all made to be generally stable airplanes. So it really doesn't matter. You're going to be jumping between different airplanes as you go throughout your training anyway. So just embrace it. Whatever is available, whatever is safe, whatever you've got, you know, find a good combination and fly with that. Yeah, I think that that's the best thing that we can do. And it gives us the opportunity to learn different things over the years. Different types of airplanes, different quirks, different philosophies. You know, Pipers have a lot of great things about them. They have some not so great things about them. Cessnas have a lot of great things about them and some not so great things. So it really just depends. One of my favorite airplanes is the Beechcraft Bonanza. I have quite a lot of time in it. Beautiful operating airplane. I have a lot of great things to say about that. Is it a great training airplane? Maybe not, but for other purposes, amazing airplane. This is a question about when I think schools are going to be opening again. This person is 0.4 hours remaining of hood time prior to their check ride. And when do I think schools are going to open again? The curve as it stands right now is looking like it's going to bottom out somewhere around July or August, worst case scenario for where we're currently trending. Now, there are a lot of factors there. Are we as individuals playing into that? Are we helping or hurting the process? There was a Facebook group last night of flight instructors that were arguing back and forth about whether or not flight instruction was an essential service right now and if they should be instructing in an airplane. And I think questions like that at a time like this are just really, I don't know, someone's missing the point. Like, there's a virus spreading, and if we keep distance from each other right now, we can stop it and we can get back to our normal lives. That's the simplicity in which I see it. So I'm not instructing, but it means that we all have to play a part in that. I know it's not comfortable. It's not great that you are that close to your check ride, and you're probably going to end up doing more time than that now just to get back up to snuff once it's time. But this is like a life-changing event that we're all going to remember, that is going to change the world in many ways. And we just need to play our part and get it over with and move on to the next thing. So hang in there. It's going to be June, July. June, absolute best case scenario. July, more likely. August is possible, even further if people were to just leave and like go do whatever they wanted, which I don't really see happening. I think most of you out there are doing your part and keeping your distance and washing your hands and doing all those things that they recommend. So I think we're going to do good. It's just going to be a bit of a frustrating, slow start to the summer. And then hopefully we can all start getting back into it. Okay. So we'll see what happens. What do you recommend to attain an American PPL if I already have a Venezuelan PPL? Taking a foreign license and coming and getting an FAA conversion is an entire process in and of itself. You also have to go through the TSA is really where you need to start. If you're going to do any flight training in the USA, you go to the TSA and sign up and start to go through that process of being vetted so that you can do flight training in the USA. Basically, what they're doing there is they are avoiding a repeat of 9/11 of training foreign nationals in our flight school system. So start there and then start to go through the conversion process if you're a private pilot. From what I understand, the foreign conversion is fairly simple. Where it gets complicated is when you start getting into instrument and commercial, especially commercial, where it can get a little bit more tricky. If I remember right, I think you have to actually do a check ride for that license. So just start working through it and you'll eventually get there. What is induced drag? Induced drag is drag created as a byproduct of lift. So one of the best places to see induced drag happening is wingtip vortices that are coming off the wing. That is a kind of induced drag that is happening. So as we increase our airspeed, we can also increase our drag because we're getting more pressure on the airplane, essentially. There's probably a better way of saying that, but that induced drag, the drag created as a byproduct of lift, is induced drag. So those wingtip vortices, you can look those videos up on YouTube. There are a lot of good ones that show that happening visually, like through some mist or some clouds or some smoke, and that gives you an idea of what induced drag is. So that's why when we have something like a glide ratio, it's like the perfect equilibrium between induced drag and parasitic drag. So we're trading off in between to find the sweet spot of where we have the least drag on either side, and we're right in the middle. So that's where your glide ratio always is on the lift drag curve. So what is the most effective way to get your ratings in the shortest amount of time? This is going to be a little bit out in left field, okay? We talked earlier about a place called ATP, about some of these flight schools that will push you through super quick. There are many flight schools out there, mine included, that would help you get through your ratings fairly quickly if you simply come with your financing ready and it's your full-time job to train and you're ready to go. That one-on-one attention from many flight schools can be something you look for. The financing ends up becoming the issue a lot of the times. So just be open-minded. You don't need to go with the place that has the best marketing and is selling this get your ratings all at once sort of thing the best. Most flight schools will approach this and be able to handle you fairly quickly. They have planes, usually instructors that are willing to go through that, and that's a helpful exercise. Now, where I really want to go with this is the most effective way and the fastest way for you or anyone to get through your training comes down to your own personal effort, all right? I think that there are many things that hold people back from becoming pilots, or at least the most common things, right? We always hear about them. There's time, there's money, sometimes there's even family, all right? I think there is another one, and that other one is effort. I have found that there are a lot of people that have the time, they have the money, but they don't have the character, the ability to exert the effort needed to do something like we're doing here. In aviation, there are no participation trophies. You go through your training, you finish the required time, you finish it to the test standards, which are called the Airman Certification Standards, and you get there. It doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter how much money you have, it doesn't matter at all. You have to achieve those things. I have found plenty of people willing to part with their money and their time, but I have seen those same people unwilling to part with their laziness and put in a bunch of effort. And I know that sounds like an odd way of approaching this, but really, if you're going to get through your training fast, if you're going to be a 40-hour private pilot rather than a 60-hour private pilot, if you're going to get your instrument done in a minimal amount of time, if you're going to get your commercial pilot done at 250 hours, you have to be the type of person that exerts yourself at home a whole lot in personal study to understand the concepts, the maneuvers, the knowledge that you need to become a pilot. So I guess that's just a little bit of an inspirational speech in that it does end up coming down to you and finding the right partners as well, because you really can't do it alone. Eventually, you got to find a great instructor or a great school, and find great partners to help you along with that. Okay, so just want to encourage you with that personal effort, that it does take quite a bit. What drove you to enter the flight school business, and what tips do you have for anyone wishing to do the same? This is maybe something I can just answer really quick. I have a big passion for aviation, and especially passing that passion on to other people. That's why I'm doing this Ask the CFI live, and then on YouTube later, live stream with you guys, because I give a whole lot, and I really want to see people achieve their dreams. I think the best and most direct way to do that is through being an instructor. We didn't have a flight school here in my hometown, and I thought it would be a great way for me to keep flying and get my time. And so I created a flight school out of one airplane and got the insurance, and I've been through a bunch of different things that I've had to do. But it's really great to be able to see someone achieve their dreams in aviation. And I know that instructors that have taken people through the entire process and see them at their check ride and see where they go after their check rides is just such a valuable part of life as a pilot. And I can't imagine not doing it this way. It's just been a really enjoyable thing to do. I've been doing aviation education for 14 years now. That's how old my company is. But it's largely been media-based. But over the last 3-4 years, I saw the opportunity to do it in person and live with people. Because at the end of the day, what matters is the individual, and I've really tried to focus on that. So I would say go for it, especially if you are going to really help people and focus on their success. Please be a good flight school. We need more of them. It would be very, very helpful, okay? So I'm all for it. Do you recommend becoming an MEI? I don't even have my multi-engine ratings at all because I don't have a reason to do it yet. I'm an instructor, first and foremost. I don't have a multi-engine airplane. Don't really plan on doing that. Don't plan on going to the airlines, so I don't need that multi yet. If you are planning on going to the airlines and doing different steps along the way like that, then absolutely, you need to move toward the multi-engine and get it done. You can get it done with a handful of places. You can get it done fairly quickly. Some places you can pay for more time to get more time in a twin engine. So it just kind of depends on your situation and where you're headed. That's when you're going to want to add the multi-engine. If you're going to become an airline pilot, absolutely, you should do it. How long have I been flying? I've been flying since I was 18 years old. I took a Discovery flight at 17. And gosh, 16 years, over 16 years now. So I'm 34. Is that math right? I don't know. But yeah, long time. Keeping in mind the current situation of the aviation industry, will it be a good time to start flight training toward the end of 2020? I think we will. Currently, based on what we're all seeing and what the data shows, it will be a good time to start at the end of 2020. Again, my advice is to start that work now. Get stuff out of the way that you can on the ground, at home, that study that you need to do at home. That would be most helpful, okay? To get you started off in the right direction. I always recommend that people get their ground school done first before starting flight training. So that's the sort of thing I'm talking about, like getting your ground school done before you actually go to do your license. I think that's a great thing to do. And we do have ground school at angleofattack.com. What helped you retain all the information there is when obtaining a private license? You know, when you are becoming a private pilot specifically, it's all brand new. It's a bit of a crapshoot. And actually, you do forget a lot of it even after you've received your rating. There are some things that you really need to nail in your head, like flight planning, weather, weight and balance, airspace. Those are things that are typically high on the list. Systems, high on the list of things you actually need to know quite a bit about, whereas some of the other fringe topics you can learn more later on. However, what I'm saying now isn't knowledge that came just from my private pilot license. I went from private pilot license to flying hundreds of hours cross country to getting my instrument rating, failing the first time, I talked about that earlier, being successful, very successful the second time and doing really well because I applied myself better. And then getting my commercial and my CFI, certified flight instructor, and my flight instructor instrument. So I've been churning through this information over and over and over and over again. And so really it's over the years that you build a really solid base of knowledge, and then you can start to add knowledge on top of that. But it doesn't happen all at once. You need to continue to learn as a pilot. If you're not learning continually as a pilot, then you are falling behind. That's why right now I really recommend people utilizing this time in a positive way, rather than just getting aviation atrophy. And atrophy is like when you're, for example, when your muscles go all bad, like say you broke a leg and it's in a full leg cast. Once you take that cast off, all your muscles are going to be gone in that leg. I don't want that to happen to you in aviation. So my thoughts are you can utilize this time now to stay in aviation, to keep your mind engaged, to keep moving forward. And, otherwise you will start to forget that knowledge. And I'm also a big believer that even though we have a flight review every 2 years to maintain your license, I'm a big believer that we should be doing that every 6 months or every year with an instructor, meaning going up and reviewing airspace, doing ground, reviewing airspace, reviewing different things and topics, and then going up and doing maneuvers in an airplane, landings, just perfecting yourself all the time. So there you go. Jake, you feel personally attacked with your broken ankle. That analogy was specifically meant for you. It's possible to have flaps out of sync in a 172. Yes, it is possible. Very rarely does it happen. I have heard of that happening before. What are your thoughts on taking a $30,000 to $40,000 loan during these times for a Part 61 program? I think you should wait a little bit. I think you should wait a month or two and just make sure that the economy stabilizes, that the airlines are getting back to normal, that there's at least a trajectory to get that way. And then I would say, once you start to see those things come back to normal, then absolutely go for it. I think that's fine. There's still going to be pilots, there's still going to be travel, and you've got to be ahead of the game, because if you're training, you're talking about a year or so out to being airline ready. So absolutely, I would say that is possible if you're going for a career in aviation. But maybe just wait a little bit and work on some other things for now to make sure everything stabilizes first. So what's next for angle of attack? I did a survey a few weeks ago about the best kind of content you guys like to see from Angle of Attack. Of course, this Ask the CFI was pretty high up there on the list of things that I'm already doing. I also do the Aviator Cast podcast, 1 Minute Wings. I've started doing vlogs again on YouTube, which I think are fun. I'm not sure how popular they are though, so I'm not sure that's gonna be a regular thing. Other people do vlogs. But high on the list of things that people would like to see coming are videos of me teaching real students and sharing that on YouTube and showing snippets of that. That's very high on the list. Another one that's high on the list is showing ground school type topics specifically, like getting really deep into certain topics. So that is something that I think I'll be getting into as well. And I think, what was the other one? So live students, vlogs were pretty far down the list. And then, basically more real flying is what I'm going to be doing next. So more in the cockpit flying, sort of thing. So actually one of the things I think I can do, this was high on the list in quarantine right now, maybe not so much quarantine, but social distancing, is maneuvers. So that was high on the list. Me going through private pilot, commercial instrument sort of stuff, specific topics, and cover just that and share those videos. So, one on traffic patterns, one on radio calls. So bunch of different things I could do there that would be applicable to my actual flight school too. So I think that's next, more real flying. I want to get out of just like the talking head stuff, because I miss flying. I'm really excited to get back to it. It'll be an interesting summer, but I know that I can do those things from basically by myself in the plane, even during the social distancing time. So we'll kind of see how that goes. Any tips to master the trim? So here's an exercise I do with students either on their first, second, or third lesson. It's usually like this, I'll even do this on the first, but it's usually like the second or third lesson, okay? We're learning about the different configurations you do as you go throughout your flight. You know, you'll go through a climb, you'll trim for the climb, you'll add that right rudder pressure, and you'll get the airplane to a state where you're basically flying hands off. And that's the whole point of trim, is where you can essentially let the airplane do what it was designed to do and fly in that state you want it to fly in and essentially be hands off. You shouldn't be manhandling the airplane all the time, okay? So we're climbing, we get that configuration. We level off or do the level off at cruise. We go through that transition and set up there as well. What I like to do to teach this, because you shouldn't be flying the trim, you shouldn't be trying to get that perfect situation with the trim, is I have the student control the airplane and just hold it, either front or back, while I roll the trim in extreme directions, okay? So I'll roll all the way forward, which means you're gonna be holding it back. I roll it all the way forward, and then I roll it all the way back the other direction to where they're pushing. Now, I do that because I want them to still see the varying pressure that they're going to need to push on the plane. What's even better is in the lower ranges of that, if you can do it with one hand, that means you can control the attitude of the airplane with one hand, keep the attitude where you need it while you're working other things, including the trim, okay? So eventually and naturally, you'll get used to just rolling in the trim as you need it directly after takeoff or after any configuration change, rolling it where you need it and kind of letting it go. One thing I learned better as an instructor is that when we get to the finite parts of trimming the airplane, after we've trimmed off any pressures that we need, there is a point where you cannot feel any pressure, yet you still aren't perfectly in trim for, say, like a cruise attitude. So what I do is momentarily I fixate between the glare shield and some sort of item outside, whether that's a mountain or a cloud or the horizon. Usually best if it's right near, very, very near where that glare shield is and where I'm staring, okay? And then I will gradually let go of the airplane and see where that nose is trending from that visual sight picture that I have. So it's a very small target I'm aiming for, and I see where that varying trim is, and I'll just bump the trim a little bit to get it perfect. So when I let it go, that sight picture doesn't move. It's not moving together, it's not moving apart, but it becomes visual after you've taken out all of the pressure that you possibly can. And again, I learned that better as an instructor because I was sitting in the right seat. I wasn't focused on the instruments anymore. So give yourself permission, and you should be doing this quite a bit in VFR anyway, to take your eyes off of the instrument and retrim just by looking at the glare shield and some sort of target in the distance to match that glare shield, okay? Okay, way out there, but why did you move to Alaska? Just as like a backdrop, I was actually born in Alaska. I was born in Anchorage. We ended up leaving here when I was 14 months old, and I think it was just in my blood. Didn't really know it, but grew up in Utah. Grew up in a pretty good like farm community with not a lot around us. But as I got into my later years, like not later, but later in my child years, like 10 and then into my teens, like suburbia started to grow up all around me. No longer could we really play out back and shoot our BB guns. Just became less free, more restrictive. And then when I became an adult, I felt that even more as I was living in apartments and facing traffic all the time driving around. I just felt like there's a simpler way to life, and I was always drawn back to Alaska. So after visiting a few times, I just decided, hey, I've got this online business, I can live anywhere, and I want to go to Alaska, I want to live there. So I did it, packed everything up and came up here, been here for 10 years, the majority of my adult life, which is cool. I've been in Alaska more in my adult life than anywhere else. I really love it here. Life is simple, life is real, good people, beautiful scenery, very healing place, and I love it here. a great place to fly as well. All right, everyone. I hope that you enjoyed some of those questions today and that they were helpful for you in just getting a little bump forward this week. I hope that you are all well and healthy and happy wherever you are. I know that the world is going through a crazy time right now, and some of you may be hurting. Some of you may be wondering what's next. Some of you may be depressed. Whatever it is, I hope that you find a positive way forward and that you keep your eye on the aviation dream and keep working toward it. We will get to the other side of this crisis, and we can do that together. Let's stay positive. Let's keep working through this, and let me know, please, if there's anything that I can do for you throughout the process. I'm always available. You can, best way to get a hold of me is to send me a message through Instagram, direct messages, and I'm most active there. It's the easiest for me to answer. If you enjoyed this and you want to see more or hear more, please subscribe on either YouTube or, if you're listening to the podcast, AviatorCast, you can subscribe there on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or what else? What's the big one? Spotify. I like Spotify a lot. Subscribe anywhere. Please like this as well. You are a part of our community. I really value each one of you and your journey. Please let me know if there's anything I can do to help you along the way. And I wish you a good week this week, all right? So enjoy. Let's keep moving forward. More content coming soon. I'll talk to you guys then. Throttle on.